Chapter 35. A Butchery of Citizens. No southern state presented more insurmountable problems to Grant than Louisiana, which had become a hotbed of hatred and corruption. Henry Clay Warmoth served as the Republican carpetbag governor of the state during Grant's first term as president.
"I don't pretend to be honest," he said. "I only pretend to be as honest as anybody in politics."
For those who didn't grasp the point, Warmoth added, "Why, damn it, everybody is demoralized down here. Corruption is the fashion." He ended up being impeached. Exasperated by Louisiana's political squalor, Grant confessed that if he knew capable, honest men in Louisiana who would accept office, he would appoint them, whether Republicans or Democrats. In November 1872, there arose a slashing race for governor between Senator William Pitt Kellogg, the Republican candidate backed by Grant, and Democrat John McHenry. Kellogg was allied with Grant's brother-in-law, James F. Casey, collector of customs in New Orleans. Although Kellogg emerged victorious, his foes refused to concede the election, which had been marked by illegalities on both sides. For months, both Kellogg and McHenry claimed to be governor, holding competing inaugural celebrations and assuming similar trappings of office. For Grant, who had hoped to intercede less in southern states during his second term, the standoff presented a baffling dilemma. He decided that General William H. Emory, his New Orleans commander, should refrain from taking sides and only act to maintain order should there be a disturbance. At the same time, he thought the McHenry government should desist from enacting legislation until the courts had decided which governor was legitimate. Despite election frauds and forgeries, Grant professed he was extremely anxious to avoid any appearance of undue interference in state affairs. His statement is noteworthy, for despite Southern charges of bayonet rule, Grant never lightly or capriciously intervened in the South, doing so only when he discovered a sound constitutional basis for action. As an adroit politician, he was very aware of the growing Northern reluctance to get embroiled in these chronic Southern disputes. A couple of days later, he informed his cabinet that in late March or early April, he planned to tour the Southern states, culminating in unruly New Orleans. This signified a new stage in his presidency. He had been in the South as a general on military business, but never as president. It spoke volumes that he dared not set foot in the South for fear of violence against him, or perhaps because he had been deterred by the legal complications of states being restored to the Union. In late February, Grant canceled the proposed trip when a Nashville friend advised him, "There are evil-disposed persons who may be inclined to do harm to him and to his party," noted Fish, who said Grant received other alarming letters. Julia Grant was resolutely against her husband hazarding the trip, and Grant soon told people, not quite truthfully, that urgent public business necessitated that he postpone it indefinitely. The Louisiana situation deteriorated with resurgent Klan activity. On January 21st, Joseph T. Hatch, a businessman, informed Grant that he was being persecuted for having voted for Grant, Kellogg, and the Republican ticket. One night, up to 20 men in disguise had ringed his warehouse, emptied more than 100 shots into it, then threatened that unless his business was moved, that in a short time they would apply the torch. In spite of Grant's reluctance to meddle in Louisiana, the wholesale breakdown of law and order made it imperative. In early March, Governor Kellogg described how McHenry supporters had seized a police station and said he would need to send in state militia under General James Longstreet to recapture it. Grant reacted swiftly. "Instruct military to prevent any violent interference with the state government of Louisiana." After a federal judge ruled in favor of the Kellogg slate, the powder keg of Louisiana politics exploded in April 1873. William Ward, a black Republican, and Christopher Columbus Nash, a white Democrat, vied for control of Grant Parish in the center of the state. Ward summoned his black supporters and warned them that Democrats would try to seize by force the county seat of Colfax, a lush place of swamps and bayous, and a black Republican stronghold. To avert this, they threw up earthworks around the courthouse, guarding it for several weeks. This display of black power was anathema to the white community. On Easter Sunday, Nash led a mob of several hundred whites, armed with rifles and a small cannon, who opened fire on the courthouse, setting it ablaze. Even though its black defenders ran up a white flag of surrender, begging for mercy, the mob butchered dozens of them. Black families were afraid to claim the many corpses that thickly littered the ground. When Longstreet sent Colonel T.W. Decline to Colfax, the latter found heaps of dead black bodies being scavenged by dogs and buzzards. "We were unable to find the body of a single white man," he reported. "Many blacks were shot in the back at the head and neck. Almost all had from 3 to 12 wounds. Many of them had their brains literally blown out." It was the worst slaughter perpetrated against blacks during Reconstruction. Staggered by this cold-blooded massacre, Grant told the Senate, "A butchery of citizens was committed at Colfax, which in bloodthirstiness and barbarity is hardly surpassed by any acts of savage warfare." A week later, Captain Jacob H. Smith of the U.S. Army arrived in Colfax with 100 soldiers, arrested 8 white perpetrators of the carnage, and counted 73 black victims. Other estimates ran as high as 300. There was no possibility the culprits would be prosecuted under local laws. Invoking the Enforcement Act of 1870, a federal grand jury handed down 72 indictments, but only 3 men were convicted. In 1876, in United States versus Cruikshank, the Supreme Court determined that the perpetrators could not be prosecuted under the 14th Amendment, because it governed only state actions, not individual ones. The Colfax murderers thus walked off scot-free, sending a powerful message to white supremacists that they could slay blacks without any penalty. In commenting on the Colfax brutality, Grant was enraged that the same Southern Democrats who accused him of unwarranted federal intrusion did nothing to repudiate such unalloyed sadism. Only federal power, he believed, could protect freed people from abuses brazenly ignored by states. As he told the Senate, "Insuperable obstructions were thrown in the way of punishing these murderers, and the so-called conservative papers of the state not only justified the massacre, but denounced as federal tyranny and despotism the attempt of the United States officers to bring them to justice. Fierce denunciations ring through the country about office-holding and election matters in Louisiana, while every one of the Colfax miscreants goes unwhipped of justice, and no way can be found in this boasted land of civilization and Christianity to punish the perpetrators of this bloody and monstrous crime." Grant seldom spoke with such full-throated passion. In early May, Grant received a dispatch from Kellogg that 2 or 3 Louisiana parishes were in a state of insurrection against the state authorities. Grant answered this appeal for troops with the carefully worded formula he invoked to justify Southern intervention. "Now, therefore, I, Ulysses S. Grant, President of the United States, do hereby make proclamation and command said turbulent and disorderly persons to disperse and retire peaceably to their respective abodes within 20 days from this date." Should they refuse to do so, Grant would send in federal troops. Perhaps as a reminder of who had won the war, he published a proclamation on May 21st, shutting government offices for the day so that employees could honor Union graves on Decoration Day. As Grant attempted to normalize federal relations with former Confederate states, he struggled with newly emergent white supremacist groups, Hydra-headed offshoots of the Klan with names such as the White League, Rifle Clubs, Red Shirts, and Knights of the White Camellia. They tiptoed around prosecution by claiming to be county militia. unlike the Klan, which was a secret paramilitary group, the White League that formed in Opelousas, Louisiana in 1874, operated with overtly political aims that included evicting the Republican Party from power. The League didn't refrain from undisguised violence. One historian described it as the military arm of the Democratic Party, and preached imminent race war, but it also engaged in economic pressure and terrorism against blacks who dared to vote. Its credo could be seen in the preamble of the state Democratic platform, which began, "We, the white people of Louisiana." Harper's Weekly wasn't far from the mark when it termed the White League an unmasked Ku Klux. In August 1874, Governor Kellogg wrote to Grant about terror inflicted upon Republican voters in Louisiana and said he anticipated more before the next election. He noted that Grant had held back from intervening in Arkansas and Texas with his new policy to let the South alone, but he predicted that federal troops would be necessary in his state so that every Republican voter should know that he would be protected if violently interfered with in the exercise of the rights conferred upon him by Congress and the Constitution. Kellogg didn't overstate the threat. That same month, White Leaguers dragged 6 Republican officials from their homes in Cossati and murdered them. Grant grew livid. "No one has been punished," he told the Senate, "and the conservative press of the state denounced all efforts to that end and boldly justified the crime." These blood-curdling events convinced Grant that despite Northern fatigue and hypocritical indifference, he lacked the luxury of pulling federal troops from the South. Told they were unnecessary and irritating to the people, he had withdrawn most of them from Louisiana, but he now revised his opinion. In early September, he notified Secretary of War Belknap to have troops at the ready. "The recent atrocities in the South, particularly in Louisiana, Alabama, and South Carolina, show a disregard for law, civil rights, and personal protection that ought not to be tolerated in any civilized government." Attorney General Williams advised U.S. attorneys and marshals in 6 southern states of Grant's fierce determination to stem violence against black and white Republicans. This was the prelude to a state of anarchy that engulfed New Orleans on September 14th. D.B. Penn, the Democratic lieutenant governor under McHenry, issued a provocative call for his militia to drive from power the usurpers, as he billed Republican officeholders. In a veritable coup d'etat, thousands of whites, many of them former Confederate soldiers instigated by the White League, barricaded the streets, overpowered black militia and the racially integrated Metropolitan Police Force led by Longstreet, and took over City Hall and the State House, killing more than 20 people. Afterward, they announced that Governor Kellogg had been overthrown. General Emory informed Grant that the rebellion had embraced nearly every white man in the community. The battle had witnessed an extraordinary event. James Longstreet now fired on men he had commanded during the war, his small army having killed 21 White Leaguers. "The streets of the city were stained with blood," wrote Grant, who released a proclamation that said turbulent and disorderly persons had conspired to overthrow Louisiana's government, and he ordered them to disperse within 5 days. To back up his words, he dispatched 5,000 troops and 3 gunboats to reinstate Governor Kellogg. Almost overnight, the federal garrison in New Orleans swelled to America's largest. Grant's decisive actions pacified a dangerously unstable situation. The insurgents disbanded, the Penn forces surrendered state offices, and William P. Kellogg was restored as rightful governor. While some northern newspapers roundly praised Grant's handling of the uprising, many liberal Republicans had tired of the black community and its eternal discontents. Contrary to the evidence, E.L. Godkin of The Nation portrayed Southern blacks as well protected by their white governments, while in states still controlled by black Republicans, the blacks have themselves become in the hands of white knaves, oppressors of the worst sort. Many Northerners were fed up with carpetbag governments in the South and wanted the federal government to disengage from the region, even if this meant transferring it to white supremacists bent on draconian democratic rule. One American diplomat believed Northern voters were impatient with this worn-out cry of Southern outrages. Hard times and heavy taxes make them wish the nigger, everlasting nigger, were in Africa. The ardent idealism that had informed the Civil War had been succeeded by a cynical, bitter revulsion. To Grant, it looked as if the country might be lurching toward a second Civil War. He had felt so outraged by events in Louisiana that he hadn't bothered to consult his cabinet before issuing his proclamation. Fish and others grumbled about being excluded, but Grant's crisp, decisive actions stopped an insurrectionary movement in its tracks. He exhibited the same spirit of command as during the war, when he had rapidly dashed off orders to his officers under fire. At one point during the Louisiana crisis, Grant had his luggage at the White House door, ready for a trip to Long Branch, when cabinet members questioned the propriety of going at such a time. He realized he needed to remain and had his trunks brought back inside. Grant remained in a quandary over the fate of the sometimes disreputable Kellogg. In an extraordinary cabinet session on September 16th, maybe the most dramatic in Grant's presidency, he and his cabinet aired their grave doubts about the governor's honesty and competence. Kellogg's weakness and imbecility were denounced by Grant and others, Fish recorded, everyone agreeing that great frauds had been committed in the gubernatorial election on both sides. At the same time, everyone believed the insurgent Democratic government shouldn't be recognized. As Marshal Jewell, the Postmaster General, admitted, "Kellogg is a first-class cuss, but there's no getting rid of him." Concerns about Kellogg's probity were dwarfed by the awareness that the Grant administration had to end the violent overthrow of a state government. "He is cool and collected," Jewell described Grant, "and thoroughly determined, and grows a little black in the face when talking about it." Attorney General Williams glimpsed a vast, insidious conspiracy in the South, poised to retake governments by force. He warned that large quantities of arms and military equipments have been taken into Louisiana and other southern states, that white leagues and rifle companies have been organized throughout the South and are regularly drilled, meeting at night and going through various military evolutions, such as pitched fights, bayonet exercises, and so forth. Such fears were validated after the morning cabinet session when Judge James Lyons of Virginia informed Fish that the entire white population of the South would consider any force to reinstate the Kellogg government as an act of war, which would be resisted. After federal troops were sent to Louisiana, Grant was besieged with death threats, often addressed to Julia as well. One New Orleans resident, signing himself a lover of justice, let Julia know her husband would be assassinated if he don't make Kellogg resign. Men are now on their way to Washington to fully execute the design of putting U.S. Grant out of the way. A Cincinnati correspondent told her, "If Grant reinstates Kellogg, he will suffer. Southerns do not want to have Kellogg and niggers over them. Grant may follow Kellogg. If he does, he will be shot at." Grant received a raft of disturbing letters from Republicans as well. A petition signed, "We the Colored People of New Orleans," claimed that the White League, in conjunction with the Democratic Party, had amassed a stockpile of up to 30,000 guns and sworn to take control of the state. "If they must kill every Negro that is in the state, they declares that just as soon as you shall withdrew the troops from Louisiana, there will not be one Republican to be found in the state." The elections that November were policed by federal troops, and McHenry and the Democrats gained control of the state Senate while Kellogg retained the governorship. Once again, both sides swapped vicious charges of election manipulation. It was alleged that Kellogg had blatantly reduced the number of Democratic legislators, while the black community said they had been threatened with physical harm and loss of jobs if they didn't exactly follow the Democratic line. Merchants refused to extend credit to planters who allowed their workers to vote Republican. Resisting cabinet pressure to tread gingerly, Grant sent Phil Sheridan to assume command in Louisiana in early January. It wasn't a conciliatory choice, nor was it meant to be. So commonplace had black murders become in Louisiana that when Sheridan conducted an investigation, he came up with a gruesome tally of 2,141 blacks killed by whites since the war, with another 2,115 wounded, almost all crimes that had gone unpunished. Right after Grant's re-election, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Nelson decided to retire, and a delegation of jurists trooped to the White House to discuss his successor. They made this courtesy call with a clear favorite in mind, Benjamin Bristow, who said they gathered around me and expressed their individual desires that I should be appointed Judge Nelson's successor. Grant invited Bristow to dine later that day, raising expectations of his elevation to the top bench. Always bedeviled by appointments, Grant hated to be lobbied and preferred to meditate on his choices privately. President is anxious to have the nomination made before the pressure upon him is made by the friends of the various candidates, Fish wrote. Grant had no consultative process in place with his staff or anything resembling modern-day vetting of court nominees. He came up with a surprise choice, Ward Hunt, a former Utica, New York mayor who had served on the New York Court of Appeals and was associated with Roscoe Conkling. The Senate confirmed him without incident. The selection didn't please feminist groups. Riding the circuit in New York, Hunt had overseen the conviction of Susan B. Anthony for illegally voting for Grant in Rochester. Grant's next Supreme Court pick proved infinitely more complex. On May 7, 1873, Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase died after 9 years of distinguished service. 5 days later, Ulysses and Julia Grant rode in the funeral procession with Roscoe Conkling. Grant resolved to let the matter of a successor dangle until Congress reconvened in December, hoping to make the right choice and spare any nominee the mortification of a rejection. This seemed to represent a step forward for Grant. Instead of making inscrutable snap judgments, he would throw open the process to a collaborative approach. As the time approached, the rumor mill kept churning out the name of Roscoe Conkling. It was then routine for presidents to nominate political figures instead of eminent jurists, but liberal Republicans derided Conkling as a poor specimen of a politician. To politics, in any good sense of the word, Mr. Conkling has not contributed a single useful or fruitful idea, sneered Godkin in The Nation, adding that his political claims to the chief place on the bench of the greatest tribunal in the world are as paltry as his professional ones. Despite the expected criticism, Grant was swayed by personal loyalty and offered Conkling the job on November 8, 1873. The New York senator was too wedded to Washington intrigue to retreat to the contemplative solitude of the court. Incredibly, he saw the job of Chief Justice as contracting his considerable power and cramping his freewheeling style. "I could not take the place," he explained, "for I would be forever gnawing my chains." On November 20th, he sent Grant a short, cryptic letter, declining the offer without volunteering a reason. Conkling may have worried that with Democrats in control of New York's legislature, his Senate seat would fall into enemy hands. Grant then offered the job to Hamilton Fish, who turned it down in a more thoughtful manner. "I insisted that I could not accept it, that it was upwards of 20 years since I had had any connection with the bar or practice. I felt that it would be important to put a younger man in the place." Grant next turned to Caleb Cushing, a 73-year-old Massachusetts lawyer and former attorney general under President Franklin Pierce, who was heavily touted by Congressman Benjamin Butler. After years of feuding, Grant and Butler had reached a rapprochement, as evidenced by Butler's fealty to administration policy. Because Cushing's age posed an impediment, Butler proposed that Grant appoint him as a stopgap Chief Justice who would resign before Grant's term expired, thus entitling him to name a replacement. Grant canvassed his cabinet on the choice of Cushing, and almost everyone balked. "I expressed a very high estimate of Cushing's ability and fitness, but felt the force of the objection to Cushing's age, and the question of the propriety of dispensing an office of that character on a conditional tenure," Fish wrote. By elimination, Grant turned next to Attorney General George Williams, who bore no exalted status as a jurist and would be replaced by Benjamin Bristow. He sent their names to Capitol Hill along with his annual message. Behind the scenes, Horace Porter and Orville Babcock had schemed to secure Williams's nomination. To many observers, Williams had done fine work against the Klan, but he lacked the superior legal mind required for the court and was overshadowed by ethical questions about his personal finances, having gotten into a bad habit of paying personal checks with government money. The reaction to him was uniformly hostile, and many senators couldn't understand why they had not been chosen instead. Editorial writers raked Williams over very hot coals. "The country should be ashamed and disgraced by the nomination of such a man," said the Cincinnati Commercial, while Louisville's Courier-Journal branded him the worst appointment yet. Nevertheless, Grant, who often became obstinate when attacked, applied intense pressure on the Senate, making the Williams nomination a litmus test of party loyalty. Some Grant advisers told him that if he plunged ahead, victory would be assured. "The Judiciary Committee is sitting listening to every idle story, every lie told by political opponents who arrive every day to feed the fight," wrote Porter. "It is simply a slanderous, rough-and-tumble political fight." At the same time, in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where a solid phalanx of opposition awaited Williams, members urged the president to yank the name. Grant, an immovable object, refused to countenance the idea, and his storied persistence once again boomeranged. "The general has done nothing heretofore that has hurt him so much," Associate Justice Noah Swain told Bristow. "Everyone now says that the third term is wholly out of the question, if there ever was a possibility of such a thing." The next day, Bristow told Grant he was turning down the Attorney General appointment. In late December, Fish found Grant alone in the cabinet room in a highly agitated state. He had belatedly grown disenchanted with Williams, telling Fish he didn't think Williams had done anything corrupt or illegal, but that there had been indiscreet things done. That Mrs. Williams had given orders for the purchase of an expensive carriage and liveries for two servants, and that the expenses for these had been paid out of the contingent fund of the Department of Justice, as were also the wages of the two men who were employed as private servants. He manifested much regret at having learned this. For Grant, this was a now familiar tale of his trusting, innocent nature betrayed. With the Senate prepared to reject Williams, Grant reluctantly withdrew his name. In another instance of errant judgment, he allowed Williams to retain his Attorney General post, despite the damaging information that had come to light. In such embarrassing situations, Grant could be hurt and angry and submit to an impulsive side of his nature. Without consulting anyone, he reverted to his earlier pick and sent Caleb Cushing's name to the Senate. However charming and erudite he was, Cushing met instant opposition. One senator unearthed a friendly, if innocuous, letter he had written to Jefferson Davis 3 weeks before Fort Sumter, recommending a friend as a Confederate clerk, and this lessened his chances for confirmation. Feeling bruised, Grant withdrew Cushing's name as well. Unable to afford another gaffe, Grant consulted the Senate leadership and came up with the name of Morrison R. Waite of Toledo, Ohio, who was, if not a brilliant lawyer, at least a proficient one, having recently chaired the Ohio Constitutional Convention. Assistant Attorney General C.H. Hill lauded him as a prompt, energetic businessman. Appeased senators approved Waite's name within 48 hours, bringing general relief throughout the country. The nation spoke for many when it wrote that Grant had, with remarkable skill, avoided choosing any first-rate man, but considering what he might have done, we ought to be thankful. The New York Tribune damned Waite with faint praise, describing him as an honest man and a fair lawyer, and that is as much as can reasonably be expected from Grant. Harper's Weekly penned a fitting epitaph for Grant's conspicuous mishandling of the chief justiceship. In both the cases of Mr. Williams and Mr. Cushing, the nomination was made not only without consultation, but without proper knowledge or inquiry, and, it is evident, therefore, without a due sense of the great character and importance of the office. Throughout his presidency, Grant remained a doting father, husband, and son. As his health worsened in late 1872, Jesse Root Grant voiced an urgent wish to see his famous son. "My father is very old and infirm," Grant told a friend, "and has conceived the idea that unless he sees me this winter, he will never see me again." Julia wasn't overjoyed about the trip. "I think it will be rather a doleful visit," she confided to a correspondent. "But still, he has to go, I suppose." However frayed their relationship, Jesse Root Grant still loomed large in his son's mind. In late May, he went into a terminal decline and died on June 29, 1873, just as Ulysses was en route to Covington. After the funeral, Grant consoled himself with the thought that his father had been resigned to his death, having reached a ripe old age without pain or sickness, he wrote. "He had been so long gradually failing that my mother and sister had discounted his death in advance." Perhaps because of complex, unresolved feelings toward his father, Grant took his death very hard. "I went up to see him and tell him I had been with his father," said Eliza Shaw. "The general could not speak a word, he was so affected." Grant's grief was understandable, since Jesse, for all his many flaws, had never surrendered implicit belief in his son. "When his faculties waned," a family friend assured Grant, "his joy in your fame and his almost childish faith in you were the unguarded gate through which interested persons imposed upon him. I am glad he never had occasion to think you had failed him." After Jesse's death, Hannah Grant decided to live in New York with her daughter Virginia and son-in-law Abel Corbin. Grant's mother still hadn't visited the White House and seemed distant from her son, perhaps feeling slighted by him or still uncomfortable with Julia and the unreconstructed Dents. In 1880, she informed a relative that U.S. Grant, as she coolly referred to him, had paid her a short visit. Then she added tartly that he seldom writes to any of us. Grant had long been caught between two willful, overbearing men, his father and his father-in-law. By a curious symmetry, Colonel Dent's health faltered a month after Jesse Root Grant died. Long a White House fixture, granted an honored, if undeserved, place at the head of the table in the private dining room, he had made no effort to muffle his views and always spouted the Democratic Party line. For 5 months he hung on in a debilitated state. On the evening of December 15, 1873, Grant, Julia, and their son Fred dined out and returned near midnight to find the colonel resting in a quiet slumber. A few minutes later, he expired without a struggle or movement of a limb or muscle, Grant wrote. A funeral service was held in the Blue Room of the White House before the colonel's body was shipped back to St. Louis for burial. Julia, still enamored of her father, was inconsolable and unable to make the trip, so Grant and Fred accompanied the remains to St. Louis. Grant had been relieved of the heavy burden of two impossibly difficult men, but Julia never fully recovered from the blow of her father's loss. Grant kept close tabs on his four children during his presidency. Fred had developed into a handsome, muscular young man with a mustache and his father's broad, open face. Grant never goaded him to join the military, but he believed that if his son chose an army career, he should enter West Point. Fred fared poorly at the academy, studying, like his father, under the well-known military theorist Dennis Hart Mahan, while piling up loads of demerits. Some people thought he put on airs, trading on his father's name. The Hartford philanthropist David Clark claimed that Fred had made himself obnoxious to the professors by advising them of what his father desired or did not desire. When Fred graduated in June 1871, he ranked 37th in a class of 41 and stood 41st in discipline. While at West Point, Fred was implicated in an ugly racial incident involving a cadet named James W. Smith, the first black cadet accepted there. A graduate of South Carolina's Freedmen's Bureau School, Smith had been sponsored and educated by David Clark. From the time he entered West Point in May 1870, Smith contended that he was verbally abused by white cadets and called nothing but a damn nigger. On June 30th, a sadly discouraged Smith told Clark that, "I have borne insult upon insult till I am completely worn out." Smith was ready to drop out in July when Grant met with Clark in Hartford and heard about the black cadet's daily persecution. Knowing Grant would be in town, Clark had published a letter in the local paper laying out the problem. "Such treatment of this noble boy," Clark wrote, "is disgraceful to the country." A distraught Clark told the president that Smith might resign from West Point. Showing sympathy, Grant insisted Smith should stay and that the battle might just as well be fought now as at any other time. Grant intimated he would shield the cadet from further abuse. But Fred Grant held decidedly more retrograde views, Clark recalled, telling his father the time had not come to send colored boys to West Point. Clark countered that if it was time for black senators, it was certainly time for black cadets at West Point. Fred sulkily retorted, "Well, no damn nigger will ever graduate from West Point." Despite Grant's encouragement, Smith continued to endure blows and insults and got no satisfaction when he complained to the academy. In September 1870, Cadet Smith was court-martialed for attacking a cadet named Wilson. He had hit him with a coconut dipper after being mocked as a monkey, and both young men were found guilty. Smith received a light sentence, but his misery had not ended. While he was marching, a cadet named Anderson kept stepping on his toes until Smith protested, "I wish you would not tread on my toes," to which Anderson rejoined, "Keep your damn toes out of the way." According to Smith, Fred Grant was one of the white cadets who invaded the rooms of three black cadets on the night of January 3, 1871, driving them into the cold. For Smith, this was a most outrageous example of lynch law. But he couldn't get the academy to punish the offenders and believed the inaction stemmed from the involvement of the president's son. According to Clark, when Smith was again charged that month with refusing to hold his head up while marching, Secretary of War Belknap consulted Grant about the composition of the court that would pass sentence. "I have received two or three letters from my son Fred," Grant supposedly said, "who informs me that the cadet is very objectionable there. Now, as this trial is to come off, Mr. Secretary, I trust that you will so make up the court as to cause his removal." Smith was found guilty and ordered dismissed. Belknap forwarded the proceedings to Grant, who commuted the sentence to a one-year suspension, with Smith set back one year, forcing him to start over as a plebe. Despite this clemency, David Clark stuck to a conspiratorial view of events, writing on June 21, 1871, that, "I feel that Cadet Smith has been outraged by the Secretary of War and the President. Fred Grant, a low, miserable scamp, has been the cause of much of his trouble." Smith and Clark charged that Grant had condoned harsh treatment against Smith to protect his son. Smith never graduated from West Point. After suffering so much ostracism, he flunked a test given by a biased philosophy professor and was drummed out of the academy, dying 2 years later of tuberculosis. As Fred ended an unhappy tenure at West Point, Grant soured on a military future for him.
"I do not want Fred to stay in the army longer than to report for duty and serve a week or two," he said, citing his many demerits. Instead of assignment to a regiment after graduation, Fred surveyed the Rocky Mountains as an assistant civil engineer, receiving a leave of absence as an army officer. Prodded by Julia, Grant, at his most henpecked, arranged for Fred to join Sherman on a European tour, and he wound up attached to his staff. Grant always showed an uncritical love of his children, a yearning that went back to his lonely days on distant western outposts. Sherman felt put upon by Grant, grumbling that being forced to hire Fred was a positive violation of law. Fred Grant had no claim to military distinction other than being his father's son. He remained unimpressed with Fred's talents. "He is a good-natured fellow, but cares for little." Ever the loving father, Grant appraised his eldest son most charitably. "Fred is a splendid fellow," he wrote, "and I think not the least spoiled yet." Sherman described Grant's adoration for his children as an amiable weakness, not only pardonable, but attracting the love of all who did not suffer the consequences. Starting in May 1873, Fred joined the Chicago staff of Lieutenant General Phil Sheridan with the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. The next year, he accompanied George Armstrong Custer's expedition to the Black Hills. Custer, a martinet, had Fred arrested for drunkenness, and later on he committed himself to total abstinence. While in Chicago, he met a pretty young woman named Ida Marie Honoré, daughter of a wealthy local plutocrat, and fell in love with her. She was an attractive, worldly young woman of French extraction, with dark hair piled high on her head and a savvy, knowing look. The Grants were all enamored of her. "Fred's wife is beautiful and is spoken of as being quite as charming for her manners, amiability, good sense, and education as she is for her beauty," Grant reported. The Grants attended their society wedding at an Honoré country residence before the young couple began their matrimonial life in the White House. Grant expressed pride when his second son, Buck, entered Harvard, where he was a student of Henry Adams and got the lowest grade in his history class. Instead of having to upbraid Buck about bad behavior, Grant could dispense more grown-up advice. In a revealing letter, he told his son, "To have the respect of all with whom you come in contact. To gain this, never deceive nor act an artificial part. Be simply yourself. Never resort to any means to make believe you know more than you really do." It was as close to a statement of his philosophy as Grant ever came up with for his children. Buck was perhaps the most likable son, one family member finding him a pleasing young man, a little nervous, but rather winning and gentle. He excelled in German and French, spending his junior year in a small German village before returning to Harvard. When he left college, he apprenticed at a law office in New York while studying simultaneously at Columbia Law School. Buck, who is a spare-looking young man, weighs 160 pounds, 20 pounds more than I weighed at 40 years of age, Grant told Badeau in 1874. "As my children are all leaving me, it is gratifying to know that so far they give good promise. They are all of good habits and are very popular with their acquaintances." The youngest son, Jesse, the veteran mischief-maker, was never as accomplished as his older brothers. Cursed with delicate health, he suffered from headaches and nosebleeds. Spoiled and overprotected, he received surprisingly little formal schooling, but in autumn 1873, the Grants packed him off to Cheltenham Academy near Philadelphia. When he lapsed into homesickness and complained of headaches, Grant allowed him to come home. Despite his limited education, Jesse was accepted at Cornell without a condition, Grant wrote, although he has never attended school but 3 years, then in an infant class,
Julia was delighted that Jesse had gained acceptance to such a respectable university.
"Do you not think that is doing pretty well?" she asked a friend. "Having been tied to my apron string all his life, as his papa says."
That Jesse was a president's son and might have something of an undue advantage didn't appear to cross Julia's mind. When Grant was elected, his daughter Nellie was just 13, and a pretty young girl in the White House was bound to captivate the press. Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly went so far as to publish her poetry. Short in stature, with dark eyes, a round nose, and a sweet expression, Nellie bore a striking resemblance to her father. Grant prized her as "my little sunshine," and everyone knew she ranked as his favorite. "My sister Nellie was his only daughter," Fred wrote, "and she was much petted and loved by him." One journalist saw that Nellie's girlish prattle was far more attractive to Grant than the compliments of congressmen or the praises of politicians. Charming, smart, and agreeable, a good dancer, Nellie was popular around the White House. In fall 1870, she was sent off to Miss Porter's school in Farmington, Connecticut. But, like Jesse, she fell homesick and came home quickly. In 1872, the Grants suggested that Nellie accompany their Philadelphia friend Adolph Borey and his wife on a European holiday, little suspecting how the trip would profoundly alter her life. Emerging from her parents' protective cocoon, she blossomed into a young woman as Queen Victoria received her at Buckingham Palace, and she toured Paris and other capitals. "She has been all her life so much of a companion of her mother that I feared she would want to return by the first steamer leaving Liverpool after her arrival," Grant noted with wonder. "But she writes quite the reverse of being homesick." In sending Nellie abroad, her parents hoped to guard her from any amorous engagement, a strategy that had ironic consequences. On the voyage home, when the Boreys fell sick and were confined to their stateroom, Nellie roamed the ship in search of adventure and found it with an Eton-educated young Englishman named Algernon Sartress. She fell in love with the handsome young man who parted his hair down the middle. He came from a family of minor gentry who owned a magnificent estate in Southampton and was wrapped in a romantic haze for Nellie. Algernon's father was a member of Parliament and had served as British minister at a European court. His mother, a former opera singer, was a sister of the renowned actress Fanny Kemble, and had counted Charles Dickens and Henry James among the fashionable guests congregating at her London salon. Grant was chagrined to discover that his pet of a daughter had escaped his paternal control and embarked on a shipboard romance. When Algernon Sartress came to dine at the White House, Grant ushered him into the billiard room for a confidential chat over cigars. "I waited and hoped the president would help me, but not a word did he say," the young man recalled. "He sat silent, looking at me. I hesitated and fidgeted and coughed and thought I would sink through the floor. Finally, I exclaimed in desperation, 'Mr. President, I want to marry your daughter.'" Both Grants had a queasy premonition of something wrong with the dashing, bearded young Englishman. Grant griped that he would prefer Nellie to be an old maid, but if she must marry, he thought she should choose an American husband. Julia sighed every time Algernon's name was mentioned, and at last confronted her daughter. "Nellie, is it possible you are willing to leave your father and me, who have loved and cherished you all of your life, and go with this stranger for always?" Nellie replied sweetly, "Why, yes, Mama. I am sure that is just what you did when you married Papa and left Grandpa." On July 7, 1873, the president sat down at Long Branch and composed a heartfelt letter to Algernon's father that bespoke deep love of his daughter and country. "Much to my astonishment, an attachment seems to have sprung up between the two young people. To my astonishment, because I had only looked upon my daughter as a child, with a good home which I did not think of her wishing to quit for years yet." His letter sounded a defiantly patriotic note. It would be with the greatest regret that I would see Nellie quit the United States as a permanent home. It is a country of great extent of territory, of fertility, and of great future promise. May I ask you, therefore, in all candor, to state to me whether your son expects to become a citizen of the United States? And what has been his habits, and what are his business qualifications? Grant confessed that he had to live off his presidential salary and could not provide for his daughter financially. Unable to deny her ardent wishes, he reluctantly consented to the match. The one condition was that Algernon and Nellie should wait a year before announcing their engagement, but that didn't seem to arrest the romance. On May 21, 1874, 250 guests shuffled into the East Room of the White House for a wedding minutely chronicled by reporters voracious for details. A multitude of spectators circled the White House, while across the street, Treasury Department clerks pressed their faces to the windows to catch glimpses of arriving celebrities, including Grant's cabinet, Supreme Court justices, and a column of generals and senators. Even Walt Whitman was susceptible to the frenzy, penning a poem that concluded, "O sweet Missouri rose, O bonny bride, yield thy red cheeks, thy lips today, unto a nation's loving kiss." While renovating the White House, Julia had converted the East Room into a sumptuous ballroom that was now garlanded with flowers, evergreens, and potted palms. Fred Grant, immaculate in military dress, served as groomsman and entered with Algernon Sartress. When Nellie swept in on her father's arm, he was, wrote Jesse, silent, tense, with tears upon his cheeks that he made no movement to brush away. Grant had approved the marriage, but lacked the guile to mask his true misgivings. Julia seemed disconsolate as she trailed along with Jesse and Buck on her arms. Officiating at the wedding was the Reverend O.H. Tiffany of the Methodist Church. Beneath a canopy of white blossoms shaped like a bell, Nellie, 18, and Algernon, 22, took their vows while Grant stared moodily at the floor. Once the ceremony ended, the guests adjourned to an elaborate wedding breakfast in the state dining room. The young couple were showered with costly gifts, estimated to cost $60,000, that accumulated in the library, including an 84-piece silver service from George W. Childs and a silver dinner service from the financier Anthony J. Drexel. The Gilded Age ostentation barely concealed the president's dismay, which broke through his usually stolid exterior. Buck left a telling remembrance. "The saddest I ever saw my father was when my sister Nellie was married. It was a lavish White House ceremony, and she married a foreigner. He was very downcast for a long time about it. That evening I found him sitting with Mother upstairs in my mother's dressing room, and he was sobbing like a boy. I was so in awe of my father I couldn't think of what to say, so I withdrew, deeply shaken." Others claimed Grant disappeared after the wedding guests left and was discovered crying alone in Nellie's vacant bedroom. Grant thought he had extracted a pledge from Algernon to become an American citizen and reside in the United States. Then Algernon's elder brother died, and he became heir to the Sartress estate. In a cruel twist for Grant, Nellie moved to England with her new husband. The marriage soon began to unravel thanks to Algernon's drinking and womanizing, and one wonders whether Grant had intuited all along his son-in-law's alcohol problem. Although the Grants tried bravely for years to pretend that Nellie was happily married, as she bore a succession of children, they admitted their extreme regret that they had lost her to England. After meeting her, Henry James evoked a forlorn Nellie, stranded among strangers, unable to keep pace with the sophisticated repartee of her mother-in-law. After one meeting, James lamented the "poor little Nellie Grant" and her "three very handsome but rather common youngsters. She is illiterate, lovely, painted, pathetic and separated from a drunken idiot of a husband. The Sartresses don't like her very much, but they like her more, I suppose, than they do their disreputable Algy. Whenever I see her, there is something rather touching and tragic to me in this eminently chubby vision of the daughter of a man who was president in a strange land, quite without friends, ignorant, helpless, vulgar, untidy, unhappy, perfectly harmless, and smeared over with 15 colors. The American press wallowed in salacious gossip about Nellie's marriage, much of it unfortunately true. Articles said that Algernon gallivanted around England, leaving Nellie for months at a time, that he had a farm in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and brought his mistress to Milwaukee, that Nellie's father-in-law settled property on her children on condition that they be educated in England, and that Grant had to send remittances to provide for Nellie and the children. Finding it too painful a subject, the president never talked publicly about the catastrophic failure of his daughter's marriage. For so protective and loving a parent, it must have been unmitigated torture to watch her being abused by a young scoundrel, especially since Grant had sensed something amiss with the young man. To make his beloved daughter happy, he had overcome his doubts about the marriage, only to see Algernon Sartress turn into a cad far worse than anything his innocent imagination could ever have conceived.